you have the cape going and find the help you need, because we're all worth the things we need to live our best life.
Absolutely. Hi, I'm Dr. George Stomopoulos, and welcome to Reasonable and Necessary, a Spendless Period podcast series on the National Disability Insurance Scheme, brought to you by the Summer Foundation. But before we go any further, please do me a favor and hit the like button, subscribe to the channel, and select the notification bell so you can be notified of future episodes. On today's episode, we're talking about NDIS appeals and what to do when you're not happy with your NDIS plan. Check it out. Hi, Mitch. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here, George.
So tell us a bit about you, Mitch.
So my full name is Mitchell Skipsey, and I'm a senior solicitor, a lawyer working at PIAC, the Public Interest Advocacy Centre. So the work I do there, a lot of it revolves around the NDIS and particularly helping people with appeals around questions around their funding for strategic litigation and other matters that we think are worth addressing through appeals, and also to try and shape the law around the NDIS to make sure that it's getting fair outcomes for people and doing what the scheme is set out to do from the outset.
Which is what we all want to do. This is a word there that I quite like. You said strategic litigation. That sounds like fun. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, this is one I do a bit of explaining at sort of dinner party contexts, because it's not a term a lot of people come across, but strategic litigation, it means that when you are, so litigation means running a court case, but strategic litigation means running a court case where you want to get an outcome for the individual client that you're representing. You do want to get a good outcome for them, but you're also looking to see what are the bigger impacts. So law through court cases can set precedents. It can help to bring issues to light and change government practices or practices of sort of companies and other parties. And sometimes the law and litigation can be a good opportunity for storytelling, for helping people express themselves and bring forward voices that are not always heard. So strategic litigation means you're running your case not just to win that one case, but with an eye on that bigger picture of the policy and the legal landscape.
And this is really important in the NDIS, isn't it? Because the NDIS is quite new in the scheme of things, and I know that over the years that there have been all sorts of issues that have been in dispute. So, you know, will the NDIS pay for transport, and, you know, we had the McGarrigle case around that, and we had this opportunity to test out what the courts had to say around what is reasonable and necessary. It's a great name for a podcast, don't you think?
Oh, wonderful. I hope it's not taken.
So that's essentially what you're talking about, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the NDIS is quite new, and that means that there is a reason for courts and tribunals to be filling in some of those gaps. But also to make sure that there's this this conversation between sort of civil society and people with disability and the NDIA and the government through that litigated forum. And it's worth saying, I mean, the NDIS, as a lawyer, when you read it, you see quite quickly it's quite a complicated piece of legal machinery from that perspective. And so there are questions that need to get worked out through these sorts of cases. And I guess what we aim to do is make sure that they get worked out efficiently and well, and in a way that gives good outcomes to the people that the scheme should serve.
Excellent. I love that you do that. I think that it's very important that we have people who are trained in the law that can help participants to assert their rights. Very important. Okay, so let's now turn to the participant who is unhappy or doesn't understand a decision that the NDIA has made. What should you do in that case?
Sure. So we're probably then, when we're talking about the NDIA making a decision, we're probably talking about either an access decision about whether you become a participant in the NDIS, or about a planning decision about whether or not you get supports funded in your plan. There are other types of decisions that can get made, but most things that people get most affected by are those access and planning decisions. And so if the NDIA has made a decision that you don't like, I mean, one of the things I think that people should do first up is make sure that they understand why that decision's been made. And if they haven't been given enough information, if they haven't been given good reasons, I really think that it's worth asking, asking the question, reaching out to the agency either, you know, through an email address that they might have communicated with you through, through various sorts of other kind of inboxes that they have. Depending on the decision, you might be able to talk to the planner or whoever's met with you and try and say, look, can you explain a bit more about why this decision's been made? I'd like to know what's happened here so I can think about what my options are next.
And then I said, it wasn't good value for money. Sorry, you'll be fine. Talk to them 12 months.
Yeah, unfortunately, I mean, the NDIS is an area where it's quite disappointing as a lawyer sometimes to see those sorts of reasons that don't really have a lot of content to them, that aren't really properly fleshed out. And I guess one thing you can try in those sort of settings is to ask a few more questions and say, well, you've said not good value for money, but here are some points that I've said I think are good value, or I'm not sure how you've made that decision. Can you talk me through it? And I do want to say, while I'm aware often people don't get a good response to that, or maybe they don't get a response at all, it's worth asking the question, because participants do have a right to know these sorts of things. It's a principle of administrative law that if government makes a decision about you, you have a right to know why and to understand it. And so I think it's worth asking those questions just to sort of, sometimes you get a helpful answer. And even if you don't, I think it might be handy later on if you wind up in a more appealing kind of contested space to say, well, look, I've been asking you this for a while. I've got the paper trail. I've got these emails I've sent you. I really just want to understand a bit more and to be able to show you've been engaging from the outset and been really looking to just be constructive and to understand why they've done what they've done.
And what if you're not happy with that explanation?
Yeah, well, I mean, so if we're talking about an initial decision, if it's a plan that you've been given that you're not happy about, or if it's an access decision that the agency said, well, we're not going to give you access to the scheme, the first thing that people can do and that they have to do as a process question if they want to challenge that is to request an internal review. So to do that, you have to contact the agency and say, I'd like you to take another look at your decision. And that means that the agency, a different staff member at the agency, has a look at all of the information that they've got. They have to look at as well at any new information you want to give them. So if you want to send them additional reports or statements, that new staff member that is doing that internal review will look at all of that and they'll make up their mind about whether or not they think the first decision, the first person who looked at your case at the agency got it right or if they got it wrong. And so that's always going to be the first step in challenging an agency's decision that you don't agree with. And if that's that can be a pathway that people feel quite frustrated to have to go down. But I do want to stress it doesn't cost anything. It's free. You can put in as much time and effort into pursuing that as you choose. You can send them additional evidence and information, but you don't have to. And it's often worth just asking the question to see, well, if someone reviews this, if another person takes a look, do they see something different? Will they actually be able to see my side of the picture a bit more clearly than the first person that's made this call that I'm not happy about?
And you have to do that within a certain time, don't you?
Yeah, there's a 3-month time frame to make that request. And it's quite flexible how you can do it as well. You can do it over the phone if you need to, if you can do it, you know, by sending a letter or by an email. I normally recommend email is best. Writing an email just saying, I'd like to request an internal review of this decision. And you can just reply to an email that you've got or send one off. Just so that you've got the record, but if you need other forms, it's quite flexible how you express it.
Yeah, and that's important because you don't want to be in a situation where you said on the phone that, like, if you just like, no, here's the email where you said this. So what is that? And I'm also paper trails. Yeah, I like plenty of paper trails. I hate hard copy paper trails. They're not good.
Yeah, but the number one thing a lawyer will always tell you is get it in writing, put it in an email.
Exactly. And so you can go through the review, and then the review comes back and they're like, yeah, nah, not value for money. Then what?
So the next step, if you get an internal review that you're not happy with, sometimes what the agency might say to you is, well, if you want, you can ask for another review or put in a request for a new plan or something. And that basically sends you right back to the start of the process. Now, there are times where people might say, you know what, I'd rather keep dealing with the agency and I don't want to escalate things, so I'm going to keep doing that. But I do want to stress that if ultimately the issue is that you and the agency don't agree, if they just have a different view in principle about what you should get, then asking the agency to keep thinking about it might not be helpful. And instead, what you might need to do at that point is go to the AAT for an external review. And so the AAT, that stands for the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. And that's an external, it's an independent body. It functions a little bit like a court, although it's not a court. And it's quite a bit more informal than a court is probably the most important distinction. It's quite a bit more relaxed.
And so did our podcast stays timely. We're recording this at the end of July, 2023. I understand that the AAT is gonna turn into something else down the track, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So, several months ago, the government announced that they're going to replace it with something new, a new body that will do external reviews of all different kinds of government decisions, including NDIS ones. So that might look different or it might look quite similar to the AAT. We just don't really know.
Yeah, so for people listening to us at home, when we say AAT, we're referring to whatever external review body ends up being, it ends up being there instead of the AAT. So that's it. So you get a fresh look at it, don't you, when you go to the AAT? It's no longer the agency looking at their own decisions. You get this set of people who, that's their job, isn't it, to review government decisions.
Yeah, so the AAT does, and I promised you earlier, George, I'd go easy on the Latin today. But yeah, what they sometimes call this a de novo review, and what that means is,
Novo.
so as
Sounds
new,
cool.
from new, from new. So it means the AAT is looking at the decision almost from scratch. They look at all the same materials, but they're not trying to look at, oh, well, what's the specific error? They don't need to find a specific mistake in what the agency did. Instead, it's about a fresh person coming in with a fresh pair of eyes to really make up their own mind from a neutral, external, from scratch, as new position. And so that does mean that it's meant to sort of be a bit of a circuit breaker to these cases where you and the agency might not agree. You can say, well, let's have someone else take a look at it who's not involved and not invested in that relationship dynamic.
Excellent. Now, earlier in the race, I had the pleasure of speaking with someone who's been through this de novo review, this new AAT fresh look review. She wasn't happy with her NDIS decision. Let's take a look at what she had to say. Hi, Felice. Welcome to the show.
Hi, George. Thank you for asking me.
It's great to have you on. Tell the listeners a little bit about you.
My name is Felice. I'm 45 years old. I have cerebral palsy and I use a power chair. I like to call myself an activist. And I do a bit of acting every now and then.
Now, tell us a bit about where you used to live and where you're living now.
I used to live in a Department of Housing high-rise in a converted accessible flat, but it wasn't 100% suitable to my needs. So one day I saw some housing at a exhibition. I think it was a Midsummer Carnival. So I applied for an apartment, and that's where I am now. So it's much, much more comfortable.
Now, I understand for this, it wasn't an easy or straightforward journey for you. You applied for SDO, and what happened?
Well, I got my plan back. It was approved, but it wasn't the housing type I needed. They approved me for a three-resident house, and I specifically asked them for a single-tenant apartment. So I had to appeal the decision.
Yeah, you wanted to live alone, and you had an NDS decision that said that you had to share with two other
Yes,
people.
there were many reasons why I couldn't accept that decision.
Okay, and I'd like to understand what it was like for you when you got that decision. How did you decide that you wanted to appeal it?
I just knew I wasn't able to literally, physically, or mentally survive in the share house condition due to my dietary restrictions, the fact that I have cats and a partner with autism who visits every weekend, so the share house wouldn't have worked. So I looked around online for some help.
What was the experience like when you had to appeal that decision? What was that like for you? What was it like to go through that?
They kept on asking for more and more evidence as to why I couldn't comply with their decision, and it was mentally and physically taxing.
I'm sorry to hear that.
They wanted me to give up. I felt like I wasn't being respected as a full human being.
Oh, that's really not what we should be experiencing. I'm sorry you went through that for us.
Thank you.
Now, you got some help from some lawyers, is that right?
Firstly, I went to a MIDA. I'm not sure what the acronym stands for, but I know that they help people get dignity and choice in their housing. I got an advocate, and the process got to a point where she didn't have the legal knowledge required. So together we applied to legal aid, and I got a barrister that way.
Fantastic that you got that support.
I was very lucky. I think they saw that I had enough evidence. That's the thing I found. Even though it's really hard, you have to keep looking and get your file really thick of things in your favor.
Yeah, it's just unfortunate that it has to be that complicated. What was the hardest thing for you?
Keeping physically and mentally focused, lots of sleep, eating properly, just trying to keep a positive mindset, because I think it took almost 18 months from the day I put the application in to the day they agreed to allow me to move into the home of my choice.
18 months is a very long time.
Yes.
To have to wait for housing. And then, how did you end up, I mean, you obviously got the decision in your favour. How did that come about?
There were, I think, five or six, like, pre-hearing conferences with the NDIA representative lawyers, my advocate, and my lawyer, and myself, and then a mediator from the AAT. I forgot to mention that they weren't actual hearings, they were like pre-hearing.
Yeah, and so that means that you try and resolve the matter before going to the hearing. So you had five of those.
Five.
That's a lot of hearings.
Five or six, yeah.
And then at the last one, what happened at the last one?
The week after the last one, the day before the hearing was scheduled, the NDIA agreed to give me the one-bedroom apartment. So
wow.
I took a breath for like 3 days, and then I prepared my mind to move.
What did you learn from the experience?
I learned that if you don't feel strong enough, you have to reach out for help, because there are organizations that will guide you through. The most challenging thing I found was all the legal and policy terms that were thrown around. They were referring to sections of the NDIS Act, and a regular person doesn't understand those things. So
yeah, and that's why you need legal help and advice from people who understand the law in the detail.
Yeah, and when you apply for a hearing, they just casually mention that there are advocates and resources out there. They don't give you much direction as to where to go for that help. I did a lot of personal research myself.
Well done for this. You obviously did a great job to get your independence and choice over your living arrangements. Any words of advice for people in a similar situation who received an NDIS decision that they're not happy with? What would you say to them?
You will get a lot of challenges thrown at you, many, many forms, many, many requests for further evidence, but you have to keep going and find the help you need, because we're all worth the things we need to live our best life, and not in a positivity kind of sense, but in a human rights kind of sense, where everyone with a disability can contribute their talents and skills.
Absolutely.
We just need the correct environment and support to do it, and that's what this game is supposed to help with.
Absolutely, Phyllis. Perfectly said. Thank you so much for coming onto the show and for sharing your story. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. I enjoy my time, and if I can help people, they're welcome to contact me.
Well, that was a pretty impressive experience, for those. What are your reflections listening to that?
Yeah, it's interesting hearing that, and a lot of what Felice had to say echoed things I've heard from my clients that I've worked with, and other people I know that have gone through the process in the past. The point she made about it being feeling quite technical, and quite hard to understand, that it can be very intimidating, and I really do understand that, particularly when lawyers get talking to each other. It can feel very sort of exclusive in a way that's not helpful. For people who are trying to sort of understand what's going on. And I also feel like the stress that Felice talked about is something I've heard a lot. The idea of it hanging over your head a little bit, or dragging on, and this idea that it's your life being dragged out into the open, to be considered and evaluated in a way that's so personal to you. I that came through really loud and clear to me, and I feel that is one of those things that can be really tough.
Yeah, I think Felice talked about that impact on her mentally and physically. There are risks, aren't there, in going to the AT in that aspect. Like, are there any other risks that people should consider? Like, I guess some people might think, well, if I appeal my SBA decision, I might then was something else. But did I review the whole thing and other risks in going to the IoT?
Yeah, so I mean, a couple of things I want to say are not risks that I sometimes hear people being concerned about. I'll start with those, and then I want to talk about some of the things that you might need to be a bit more worried about. For starters, you don't have to pay anything to go to the AAT. It's free, and so there's not a cost involved in making that application. It's also not a situation where if you lose, you have to pay the other side's legal fees or anything like that. There's no penalty for that sort of an outcome, whereas there can be in other sorts of legal proceedings, and sometimes that makes people feel a bit uncertain. But as you say, there are things that you might need to consider. One possibility is that the tribunal could take a fresh look at things, and it's possible that they could decide that they think you've been funded for something that you probably shouldn't be. But I guess I would also say that's not something I've seen in practice, and it would be very rare, because for that to happen, it would probably need the AAT to the agency, the NDIA would generally need to be making that argument that they had funded you for something that they shouldn't have funded you for, and that would be unusual. So it's quite rare that people go to the AAT and wind up with an outcome that is less than what they had going in. I've never seen it happen.
What about when you, at that first stage that we talked about, if you ask for a review of your decision by the NDIA, can the second person looking at it at the NDIA say, oh, that's too generous, like cut everything back, like, is that a risk?
I suppose that is possible. I've never seen it myself, but I would say it's probably, given that the person who is reviewing is supposed to take a fresh look at everything, it is possible. The only thing that might have changed would be that you've given them additional information to support your own case. So I would be surprised if that happens very often.
I'm sure some people to know those things, because I know that it can be, your NDIS plan is really important to you, and it can be incredibly stressful to think, oh, I might apply for SDA and then I'll lose my call supports or that kind of thing. That people do worry a lot about that, so it's important that we do let people know that it's not a huge concern.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's such a it can be such a sort of an intimidating process to feel like you're going up against a government agency. I absolutely hear that very often from people saying, I really want to make sure I know what the risks are or how I need to make sure this doesn't go badly for me.
I would recommend that you speak to an advocate. Like, if I know that advocates are overworked and they're hard to find, but is that what you'd recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. I think whenever possible, people should absolutely try and get advice from an advocate, and perhaps a lawyer, depending on the complexity. I mean, Felice, in her case, she said she started talking to an advocate, and when it got to a particular stage of legal complexity, they decided together that she needed to talk to a lawyer as well. But I think the earlier you can get that advice and that help, someone to paint you a bit of a picture of what might come next, that's going to leave you in a much better position to make those decisions. But then I also, I would want to stress that the decision is yours to make. That I would hope a good advocate or a good lawyer or anyone advising you at that point is being empowering, is saying, well, I want to put you in a position to have choice and control over this part of your life, about whether you're going to challenge this decision or whether you're going to say, well, maybe that's not something I want to do for now.
Okay, so you've got some advocacy advice and you're thinking that you want to fight this. What do you need to prepare? I'm assuming your advocate will hopefully help you do this, but for people like me who love doing things independently, what would I need to prepare?
Well, something I'd better say actually at this point is that before you get to the point of thinking about that, you need to be mindful that there's a tighter time frame for the AAT review, that you have to lodge the appeal to the AAT within 28 days, and that's not necessarily a lot of time. So, 28 days is the time from the time you get the internal review decision that you want to challenge. You've got 28 days to apply to the AAT. But the thing about that
Get
initial
this
application,
out from.
get your skates on, but that initial application does not actually have to have very much in it. It can be quite brief. You basically need to provide just some contact details about yourself. Usually a copy of the decision that's been made is also something they'll ask you to give them so that they know what's the decision that you're trying to review. And you need to give them just a brief understanding of, you need to give some reasons for review, for why you want to review it. But those can be very, very short. They can be as short as saying, I don't agree with this decision, and I think it instead I should have been funded for X, Y, and Z. And that's really all you need to write. It can be one sentence. And
And
so,
you do that on the website, the AAP website?
yeah, you can do it on the website, or there's actually a paper form as well that you can download and
Okay.
print out and send in. But in those situations, I would say if you're finding it hard to manage getting advice and making up your mind about everything within those 28 days, something you can do is file your application with the AAT, and sort of give relatively brief sorts of reasons. You don't have to give a full body of evidence or anything. And then that will buy you some time to go talk to an advocate. And if you talk to an advocate and decide you don't want to go forward, you can always go back to the AAT and say, I know I've applied, but I'd like to withdraw my application now. And that's totally fine to do.
How long does the AAT take?
Unfortunately, George, the news can be a bit mixed on that front. I went and looked up some stats about this actually because I wanted to make sure I had the up-to-date information. And at the last data that they put out, which was about 2 months ago now, It was 31 weeks was the median time it took. So that's the median. That's obviously sort of a kind of an average. And some will take longer and some will take shorter, but a bit over 6 months is not a bad ballpark to be able to take away to say, well, if I apply to the AAT, I'm not necessarily expecting it to be over by next week. It's something that I am investing in a bit of a longer process of appealing, of reviewing, and of sort of arguing for my case.
That's over half a year. Are there ways that you can get the decision expedited or made happen faster?
Well, some cases are a little bit easier to ask for a quicker decision on. So some cases where perhaps a person has got certain kinds of evidence already, if they've already got every report they're possibly going to need and they're very happy with those, then that can sometimes mean that you can push things forward more quickly. And there are sometimes processes where you can ask the tribunal to move a bit quicker or talk to the agency, and the agency might be willing to settle the case a bit more quickly. It really does vary case to case.
And in that time, you need to gather evidence and do some homework, I guess. What if you need info from the NBA? Like, can they help you, or do they not want to talk to you now that you're taking it to court?
They're not necessarily going to try and quote unquote help you to win, because obviously you're up against each other in that space. What is important to know is that when you apply to the AAT, the NDIA has to give a copy of every document that they think is relevant. So they give a copy of every document that's relevant to the tribunal and to you. And so that's normally a big old binder or a big old electronic PDF document. Basically giving the full picture of what's happened. And that's often quite helpful, particularly if you maybe don't haven't been able to keep records of everything that's happened so far. You can also then look through that and make sure, check and see that everything's there that you think should be there, or work out, oh, well, looking through this big chunk of documents I've got, I've realised that it doesn't include this report or that piece of information. Or maybe it helps me to see that what's missing is something that I now need to go and get and provide.
And you've got the folder, you've got all the info, and then what does the AAT send you an email or write to you and say, oh, it's your turn now, we've got a hearing set up? What happens next?
So usually the next step is what's called a case conference, which is where the AAT gets everyone together over the phone and says, let's have a talk about where we're going to go next. And normally that conversation will be relatively informal between, again, you or your representative, the agency and their representative, and the tribunal. And you have a conversation about, well, I would like some time to get this evidence. It's helpful to go to that case conference, which will happen, a month or two in usually, and say, I want to get three reports. I think that they'll take me another 2 months to get. So can you give me 2 months to get reports? I'll file those. Let me ask the agency what they're going to get. The agency might say what they intend to provide, or if they want to get their own information. And then the tribunal might make some orders to say, some directions to say, here's what the timeframe is and here's what the next steps are. And then once that's done, they'll probably call you back in for another case conference. And that's typically how the tribunal will run things. They'll have a case conference, assign some homework perhaps, set some timelines, and then people go away and do it until the case is ready to go to a hearing. And then the tribunal will say, right, we're ready to have a hearing. Let's set down a hearing date. And some sort of opportunities for both sides to exchange any legal arguments they want to swap back and forth.
What's it like though, being in that room with the NDIA? I've heard stories where it can be quite intimidating. Like, is there support to do with that? And
Yeah, so something that's maybe important to note is that they're normally phone calls rather than getting in the room. And the phone call format, I think, is quite appropriate because it means that it doesn't maybe feel so intimidating. They're supposed to be quite constructive in tone. And I often say as well to my clients when I'm representing someone, I say, I'll go to the case conference so you don't have to, and I'll talk to the agency's side. If somebody doesn't have a lawyer though and doesn't have an advocate, then that might not be an option and participants might have to go to those phone calls themselves. Look, I mean, I think a common complaint I have heard is that sometimes people do feel very intimidated in that setting by the way that the agency's lawyers can act. They maybe don't sort of speak in accessible kinds of language. They might be asking for things that aren't well explained, or are perhaps said in ways that are a little bit insensitive. I do think that's a real concern that people have raised. I think I would say I've seen it get a little bit better over the past year or so. There have been some efforts by the agency and their lawyers to be a little bit more gentle about that approach and a little bit more accessible, a bit less lawyer-y about it and a little bit more human. But it's also, yeah, I would say that people still do come away with and have stories of pretty poor experiences in those conferences.
Yeah, I just want to know that, you don't have to go to all of them. The advocate can go on your behalf, is that right? And the lawyer can go.
Yeah, your advocate or your lawyer can go. I would say it's often it can be a little bit tricky though if people want to have a support coordinator go. I often think that can be quite tricky because it puts the support coordinator in an awkward position where they're kind of arguing for you to get more funding or something, and that funding might ultimately be used to pay a support coordinator. So it's
Can you
often,
take family and friends?
yeah, family and friends are sometimes a better choice if you can, to say, can they be my support person to go with me and help support me?
Yeah, I want people to know that they're not on their own. They can get support to go through the process. That's very good. We saw that Phyllis didn't even get to a hearing. She had about five pre-hearing conferences. Is it common that things just get solved just before the big day?
That's very common. I looked up these statistics too, actually, and
Oh, beautiful.
the most recent stats we've got, 60% of AAT appeals for NDIS cases get settled, where the agency and the person agree that, yep, okay, let's settle this. And that normally means that the agency has agreed to compromise or to concede and say, yeah, you were right all along. It usually means that's something like that is what's happened. So 60% is where that happens. Another 31% of cases, the person withdrew. So the participant has said, you know what, I don't want to keep going with this, either because I don't think it's important anymore, or maybe I'm finding it too stressful. So that's 91% of cases get settled or withdrawn. Only 2% of cases actually go to a hearing at the end of the day, and that's a hearing and a final decision by the tribunal. So it's actually very uncommon for the tribunal to be the one that makes the final decision.
It's funny, I spoke to the former CEO of the NBIA and I said, oh, you're spending all this money on these court cases, wouldn't you rather put it into the agency and into people's plans? He said, oh, no, that's a different bucket of money. So they can just get more money from the lawyers somehow. I don't know how that really incentivizes them to improve their processes.
Yeah, unfortunately, there always seems to be enough money for more lawyers. Yeah, I think everyone should be able to agree that at the end of the day, the less cases that need someone like me or people on both sides like me to get involved, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. What are some of the more common mistakes that you see the agency make when you're working within the space?
Yeah, so one that's very, I think, looms large for us doing strategic work is that sometimes you see policies that the agency has that are really unhelpful, either because they don't direct people making agency decisions to consider the right things. They don't sort of draw your attention to people's choice and control, you know, where they say it's not value for money. I think they're not necessarily helping agency staff to consider the right kinds of value, you know, the things that are really personal to somebody. Like in Felice's case, I think a well-written policy or a well-written set of guidelines could have made sure that a planner was considering those important things for Felice without sort of just writing them off and saying, oh, no, it's too expensive. So I think the policy landscape is something that needs a bit of
I
tinkering.
agree with you so much on that. I often look at the organisational procedures of the NBIA and I'm like, hang on, Where did that come from? Just last night, I was, because as I do on a Sunday night, I like to read NBA policy, as we all do, right? And I came across this piece of policy that said that if you have high support needs and you need shadow shifts, and we need another support worker to train a new support worker, we will fund up to 6 hours a year for people with high support. I'm like, how do you get 6 hours when you've got people on ventilators who have pink feeds? These policies, I often wonder how they dream them up. They don't necessarily make any sense whatsoever.
Yeah, and some of them I think don't make good sense. You know, they just seem obviously sort of out there and perhaps misguided. And some of them are actually unlawful, in that sometimes the tribunal takes a look at these guidelines and it says, oh, that's actually not legal or not enforceable. And
Do
there's
you
a
have an
number of cases.
example?
There are a number of different areas that they've done this in. So the tribunal said it off the top of my head. It said it about transport policies. It said it about assistance animals policies and the kinds of cases where someone can get an assistance animal. It said it about certain things to do with SDA. There's sort of a line here or there, a bullet point or two that just is really not something that the tribunal is going to let stand up.
So what happens if you go through the whole process of the AOT and you end up with a decision that you're not happy with?
Yeah, so in that case, basically your only option to appeal that decision would be to go to court. And going to court, we talked about how the AAT is de novo earlier. The court is not de novo. The only thing the court can do is look and see if the AAT has made a legal mistake, if they've made a sort of a technical legal error. So I guess because of that, I normally wouldn't just be saying to people, if you don't agree with the AAT, you should roll the dice on going to court. I would say before you do that, you should really straight away go and get legal advice and hear what a lawyer has to say about whether they think there's the right sort of pieces there for it to be worth running as an appeal. Otherwise, there are much bigger risks in going to court. It can be quite expensive. There can be, and you really need that advice to help you navigate whether or not you've got a chance, whether or not you've got a case that can get up.
But people have gone to court and people have won in court, haven't they?
That's true.
That's
There's
a
been,
federal court, right?
yeah, it's the Federal Court of Australia, and so that is true. I think in most of those cases that they've been successful. I think in almost all of them. It's been one where people have had to have lawyers involved, and I would assume in those cases they had lawyers ahead of time able to advise them that it was worth doing. So really I would be saying that the first step and a very important step is to get legal advice before you go applying to the court.
Definitely lawyer up before you go to the federal court, because you want to make sure that you're making the right decision. And I just want to really thank all the people who have gone to the federal court, because those decisions have been very important. I know that with the IoT decisions, the NDIS, we don't really need to follow them. But if someone's gone to the federal court, then there is a requirement, isn't there, that the agency reviews that policy to be consistent with that.
Yeah, exactly. The courts are an important tool for doing things like clarifying the law, etc. But they are a different kettle of fish to the tribunal.
Any last words of advice, Mitch, for our listeners who are thinking, oh, I'm not quite sure what to do, I'm about to go and take the plunge and get my decision reviewed? Any last words of advice or encouragement even?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing I'd say is something I said a little bit earlier on in our conversation is from the start, it's worth sitting down and working out what's important to me, what are my priorities, what kinds of supports perhaps do I really need and I'm going to fight for, and perhaps also How do I feel about things like investing time and effort? What am I willing to do? And I think that's really helpful as an exercise because it means you'll be able to ask the right questions, to make the right sorts of decisions in running a case, and to make sure that you are exercising as much choice and control over your appeal process as you can. I guess the other thing I would say is don't be afraid to ask for help. It is a complicated thing. It's a complicated sort of scheme from a legal perspective. It can often feel intimidating. It's absolutely the right thing to do to go asking for support from advocates, from lawyers, from friends and family or people around you that can help support you through it.
Absolutely. And I know that you've been working with the Housing Hub to develop some resources to help people through all this. So we'll provide some links to those in the description below. What kind of resources can people expect to find there?
Yeah, we're really excited about these. It's a series of kind of how-to guides that we're putting together. And those are designed to be sort of signposts for people going through the process to say, here are the things that you might need to consider at each step of the process. You know, how to lodge my AAT application, how to go get evidence, how to decide what things I need to get for my case, how to go to a case conference, all of those different steps that we've talked about today. We hope that there's going to be a how-to sheet that's useful for somebody. And there'll also be some templates that we'll try and produce to go with those for things like here's how you might write certain kinds of letters asking for things like reasons, or here's how to do certain steps. So we're really thrilled, and I hope that those will be something that's useful for people, either if they are not able to get as much support as they would like, or even if they do, I hope it's a helpful guideline so that people can read those and know, oh, here's what my lawyer is doing or considering on my behalf, or here are some of the things that might help me decide the right questions to ask my advocate.
Thanks, it's really great that you're helping people in that way. Thanks for all the amazing work that you and the team at Connect do. I think that's, we're really lucky to have an organisation like Connect, to just, you know, bring that really essential legal perspective on human rights issues that we're facing when we rely on the government to make decisions about our lives.
Not a problem, George. Thanks very much for having me on.
Have a great afternoon.
You too.
That's all we have time for on today's episode of Legal and Necessary. Thank you to our podcast partners, the Housing Hub, and the Public Interest Advocacy Centre. We love your feedback, so please hit the like button and share your thoughts with us in the comments below. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay well and reasonable.